Are you going to switch? Switch me on?
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the second week of summer school. Many familiar faces from last week, and I'm sure there are new faces who haven't seen in the first week. Welcome. And when I was thinking about introducing Jean Wilcox Wilson, I thought most of you know her. She probably doesn't need an introduction. And I'm told today, so maybe I should introduce her as Jane Austen.
Well, I did make an effort to make a dress for you, so.
So we have Jane Austen. For those who don't know Jane Wilcox Wilson, she's actually Dr. Wilcox Wilson. She has, can you hear me now? She's Dr. Wilcox Wilson. She has, from the University of London, a BA, an MA, and a PhD. And she started a career as a visiting lecturer in English at the University of Munich in Germany. She's then been a lecturer in English at the University of London and teaches regularly for the Dominican University of Chicago's London program. She also works with her husband Cecil Wolfe in their long-established independent publishing house and is general editor of their Bloomsbury Heritage War Poets and Poets of the 1890s series. Besides lecturing extensively in England, I'm not going to even list all the universities, suffice to say they're all prestigious universities, the Society of Fellows, University of Columbia, New York, the National Portrait Gallery in London, the Imperial War Museum in London, the University of Washington at Pullman, and then she's also a keynote speaker at many conferences in Britain and America. And for those, you need to be invited. So you don't just become one of those. You have a long established academic career and then you get invited. She has many publications. I counted them and I'm not going to tell you how many, but I picked them out randomly because they're the ones that appeal to me. Isaac Rosenberg, poet and painter, a biography. Virginia Woolf, Life and London, a biography of place. And Siegfried Sassoon, The Journey from the Trenches. There are many publications. Some of them are on sale. I saw them at Bay Books. And then she's also a regular contributor to the Daily Telegraph, The Guardian, The Times, and other national board sheets. So please welcome Dr. Jean Wilcox Wilson.
What can I say after such an introduction? Except just one thing, that you'll need a mortgage to buy my Siegfried Sassoon book at the bookstore. Your exchange rate is so bad. But, you know, he said very sweetly he would order my latest Sassoon book, Siegfried Sassoon, Soldier, Poet, Lover, Friend. Isn't that a good title? You notice I slipped in the lover. And I don't think you'll be able to buy it unless you get a mortgage. So go back and organise it today, and I'll sign them on Friday for anybody who's bold enough. There is a much cheaper book, Virginia Woolf, Life in London, there. Today, now don't be put off by seeing Thomas Coriat on the screen. You'll find all about him. Does anybody know Thomas Coriat? No. Oh, good. I'm so glad. And I'm going to talk a little bit about Wordsworth, but really, in effect, I'm going to introduce you, as well as talking about Jane Austen, to the concept of walking, because it hasn't always been an acceptable thing. I know you're all mad keen on walking. Do you know that this course sold out on the first day? I thought I must do more walking, mustn't I? I'm going to start. I wandered, lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils, beside the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze. Continuous as the stars that shine and twinkle on the Milky Way, they stretched in never-ending line along the margins of a bay. 10,000 saw I at a glance, tossing their heads in sprightly dance. The waves beside them danced, but they outdid the sparkling waves in glee. A poet could not but be gay in such a jocund company. I gazed and gazed, but little thought what wealth the show to me had brought. For oft, when on my couch I lie in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon that inward eye which is the bliss of solitude, and then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils. What, you may say, has that poem got to do with Jane Austen? Jane Austen and walking, from a very different kind of writer, of course, this poem. It is, of course, one of the best known poems, I'm sure most of you know it, on the subject. But it would be even odder to discuss the sudden rise in the popularity of walking at the end of the 18th century without bringing in Wordsworth. For it was Wordsworth, more than any other single writer of that period, who convinced English readers of the joys of walking, who persuaded them to see walking as an end in itself, and not simply as a means of getting from one place to another. I mean, walking was a very pedestrian, sorry about the pun, very pedestrian, you see where it comes from, activity to begin with. There's a lovely book written by a man called Maurice Marples, like Miss Marples in Agatha Christie. Maurice Marples, who wrote a book called Shank's Pony in 1960. And that blessed thing, the internet, will show you where. Although my internet's broken down at the moment where I'm staying, and I realise how much we all depend on it, don't we? He writes, "Mankind in general has seldom regarded walking as a pleasure. No doubt it has too often been the case that to walk meant simply that a man could not afford to ride, so that walking has nearly always been regarded as the poor man's way of getting about, to be avoided whenever possible. It is true that among the leisured classes of the more civilized peoples in different epochs, strolling, as opposed to walking, in the sense understood by walking tourist or hiker, has generally been enjoyed. Not to go beyond Europe, we find the Greeks taking pleasure in the combined operation of walking and talking. And the American poet Robert Frost, who loved walking and talking, had a phrase, and it was called talks walking. Lovely phrase, isn't it? And you know exactly what he means. And well-to-do Roman men of culture like Pliny the Younger laid out shady walks and porticos at their country seats when they might stroll at leisure. The habit may have spread even more widely among the social classes, though it was not understood by the barbarians. Strabo has a story about Spanish tribesmen who thought the Roman centurions must be mad when they went for a stroll after parade, and offered sympathetically to guide them back to the camp. But no Greek or Roman ever went on a hiking tour. Well, walking was regarded in this way almost universally in Europe until only a little more than 200 years ago, and it's not a long time in the history of civilization. A great deal of it, of course, was going on during the intervening centuries, and the main roads of Europe must have been absolutely crowded with people who were walking to get somewhere, who just simply couldn't afford it. Or, and I'll touch on this slightly, pilgrims who were going walking with a religious purpose in mind to show their devotion. The Buddhists, I think, even crawl, don't they? But I think most English people think walking's punishment enough. And the pilgrims, but until the end of the 18th century, the man who could afford to ride despised the pedestrian and naturally disliked walking himself. A character in a play by Congreve, William Congreve, called The Way of the World, said, "I nauseate walking." Wonderful use of the word nauseate. I'm going to use it in future. As Marples points out, only a few eccentric Englishmen ever walked long distances for pleasure, though there were many who did so in the name of sport or for a wager. So for a bet, you know, I bet you can't walk from so-and-so to so-and-so. Thomas Coryat, now you see where he comes in, Thomas Coryat, 1577 to 1617, so 16th, 17th century, was one of these eccentrics who nicknamed himself the Peregrine of Odcombe. That was the place he was born. He was the son of the vicar of Odcombe, and he'd had a good university education. But he somehow was terribly keen, quite unusually for the time, on walking. Not so keen that he went to Venice by foot, but when he got to Venice, he found he'd run out of money. So he had to walk back. And being a very canny man, he thought, aha, I can write about this. He also found out wonderful things along the way. He found out that the Italians, for example, used forks, strange instruments, and brought the knowledge back to England. He knew about early music and early music instruments. It's a very fascinating book. And the book is called Coryat's Crudities. The title alone is worth getting the book for, I think. And it's been kept in print ever since. Now, isn't that amazing? And based entirely on his travel back by foot. And when he got back, he hung up his boots, which, of course, were rather worn by this time. I don't imagine there was much soul left to you. He hung them up in his local church. They were consecrated, blessed, and hung up in the church. And somebody stole them in the 18th century. So I can't show you a picture of Coryat's crudities and his boots. Coryat's crudities hastily gobbled up in 5 months' travel in France. That's how long it took him to get back, France, Italy, etc. There's a man who's done his own version and has done the same walk in the 20th century. And, 21st century, Tim Moore, and you can certainly Google this one, who retraced Coryat's steps, published his own account called Continental Drifter. The emphasis slightly shifted. Coryat himself was proud of his achievements, often signing himself after this as the Odcumbian Leg Stretcher. And in recognition of it, as I say, dedicated his shoes. Now, another eccentric walker who set out on what he called his pedestrian pilgrimages the year after Coryat returned triumphantly from Venice was the Scotsman William Lithgow, a rather more dour character, I feel, 1582 to 1650, driven to the roads apparently by a failed love affair, which had ended with his lover's brothers cutting his ears off. So I don't suppose he heard very much on the journey, but he certainly journeyed. Asia Minor, Palestine, North Africa. And he calls his book The Total Discourse of the Painful Peregrinations of Long 19 Years Travails. Now, you see the pun on travails, do you? Lots of others. I won't be tempted, except to mention someone you will know, and that is Ben Jonson. Ben Jonson, the Elizabethan playwright, who set out at the age of 45, weighing 20 stone. Do you do stones here? Or do you? You don't. What's 20 stone? You do. Well, anyway, that's very big. And he set out in 1619 to walk from London to Scotland. I wonder if he had one of those kind of convoys going with him. I always think people cheat nowadays, you know, a helicopter hovering overhead just in case they get tired. two pounds short of 20 stone. Sorry, I maligned him. And with a very stout stick, he couldn't have been easy. It was undertaken possibly for the benefit of his health. He referred very proudly to his mountain belly. So he's obviously working on getting it down. But sadly, the account he wrote has not survived. Did he ever write it? I wonder. He's probably so tired by the time he finished the war. These eccentric pedestrians were, however, exceptions to the prevailing attitude towards walking as a necessary evil. So that's what it was at that time, a necessary evil, until the end of the 18th century, when a profound change occurred, initiated in England, as I've said, by Wordsworth, and to a lesser extent, his fellow romantics. The poets Coleridge, Keats, Byron, Shelley all walked extensively, and the essayists Hazlitt, De Quincey, and Lamb. And they've all written very, very nice. If we had 2 weeks instead of one, we could have done that first. My favourite period of poetry to some extent. Wordsworth's attitude to walking, an extremely positive one from the start, was almost certainly influenced by his love of France. And when he took a mammoth walking tour there, he was supposed to be revising for his finals at Cambridge. And instead, he had a long walk. I'm sure he did him a lot of good. And that was in 1790. And he would subsequently return to France. And there in France, he would encounter a movement that hadn't yet reached England, which was a movement, the movement about sensibility, about feeling, not reason. The rationality of the 18th century was already being challenged. And it wasn't reason that we were interested in as writers. It's sensibility. You know Jane Austen's sense and sensibility, feeling. It can sometimes get out of hand, as in that novel by Jane Austen. And this age of sensibility featured an increased focus on subjectivity and introspection that would, to some extent, account for the changed attitude towards walking, because one of the things that walking does, of course, is allow you to think to yourself about things, to feel things as you go along. Nobody's coming to say, have you done the shopping, or what are we having for dinner? Until I've got a lot of children, can't you? And this was exemplified, this movement, by one of the movement's greatest writers, and you will, of course, know him, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, his Reveries of a Solitary Walker in 1782, another one for your list, the Reveries of a Solitary Walker, a last-minute addition to his renowned Confessions, spelt out the pleasures of pedestrian activity, and this is extract 2 on your sheets, if you like to follow. In thinking over the details of my life, Rousseau wrote, which are lost to memory, what I most regret is that I did not keep a diary of my travels. Never did I think so much, exist so vividly, and experience so much myself, if I may use that expression, as in the journeys that I have undertaken, that I have taken alone and on foot. And this is something that is tremendously modern as well as 18th century. He says, there is something about walking which stimulates and enlivens my thoughts. When I stay in one place, I can hardly think at all. My body has to be on the move to set my mind going. The sight of the countryside, the succession of pleasant views, the open air, a sound appetite, and the good health I gain by walking, the easy atmosphere of the inn, the absence of everything that makes me feel my dependence, of everything that recalls me to my situation. All these serve to free my spirits, to lend a greater boldness to my thinking, to throw me, so to speak, into the vastness of things, so that I can combine them, select them, and make them mine at will, without fear or restraint. And that is the Reveries of the Solitary Walker. As I pointed out, by the time Wordsworth went to live and study in France. He had already taken an ambitious walking tour there with his friend from Cambridge, Robert Jones, at a time, incidentally, as he relates in his famous poem, probably his most famous poem, The Prelude, in Book 6, when he should have been studying for his finals. But this epic trip of 300 miles in 2 weeks, now that's quite something, isn't it? I'm not much of a walker, but I would regard 30 miles, not in 2 weeks, admittedly, but I would imagine that if I walked 30 miles, I'd be proud of myself. But it exposed him to the early stages of the French Revolution. The fall of the Bastille on the 14th of July had occurred in 1789, the year before he walked. You're probably familiar with those stirring words on the effect it had on him. Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven. And as he further explains, 'twas a time when Europe was rejoiced, France standing at the top of golden hours, and human nature seeming born again. And I see walking as part of that rebellion against the conventions, rebellion against the established regime. His French trip also reinforced his own childhood, adolescent experiences, growing up among the dramatic scenery of the Lake District. And there is no better training, I imagine, for a walker than to grow up in very beautiful scenery that invites exploration. He had a very sad story to some extent. His mother died when he was 8, and because his father was then alone with four children, I think, 5 children, he sent Wordsworth and his older brothers off to school. To school at Hawke's Head, right in the centre of the Lake District. And they were very fortunate because they were boarded with a woman called Anne Tyson, who was very relaxed about them going out. I mean, nowadays, you wouldn't let your child out. Especially not in Cape Town, you wouldn't. But even in London, you wouldn't. Alone, to walk sometimes all night. Extraordinary. All night, intoxicated by the beauty and mystery of his surroundings. Also, it must be admitted, by bird nesting. He was rather ashamed of this afterwards. From an early age, it seemed, well, you ought to see Wordsworth, oughtn't you? This is the young Wordsworth, just after he's done all these mammoth tours in the Lake District. I might as well show you what he came to. Wordsworth droning his way towards the verge of the grave, somebody said. But he was always a great, great walker, as we'll see. De Quincey, and you know, I'm sure you know about De Quincey and the confessions of an opium eater, great friend, once remarked, although women weren't terribly keen on Wordsworth's legs, they were pointedly condemned by all female connoisseurs, says. But Quincey wasn't a female, and Quincey was very admiring. He remarked, undoubtedly, they had been serviceable legs, beyond the average standard of human requisition. For I calculate, upon good data, that with those identical legs, Wordsworth must have traversed a distance of 175 to 180,000 miles. The poet, the modern poet, Simon Armitage, I don't know whether any of you know Simon Armitage, reporting this remark in his book on his own epic walk on the Pennine Way in England, Walking Home, it's called, published in 2012, says that his own favourite walk, described in Dorothy Wordsworth's journal, I mean, he loved the way in which they regarded 5 miles there and 5 miles back as nothing. His favourite walk was when they went in the morning to fetch a mouse trap, a journey of 10 miles, popped out before lunch for a mouse trap. It was this early experience of serious walking among breathtaking scenery, Wordsworth claimed, that first inspired him to write poetry. And that's really why I've got into Wordsworth a little, because, of course, one of the functions of walking, according to some of my writer friends, is for inspiration. And we'll see this with Virginia Woolf. We'll see it with Dickens. I actually find myself totally distracted, so I don't go for walks. I just sit down and try. But Dorothy's journal And you know, his sister Dorothy was a great walker, which is unusual for the time, as we'll see. His constant companion before he married, and she was with him. And in her journal, which is a wonderful read, in her journal, so book list will be getting very long by now, she says that she makes the connection between the walks and the poetry. For instance, when they go to visit Coleridge, the poet Coleridge and his wife at Nevis-Doey, a mere 3 miles walk away, she writes, March 18, 1798, the Coleridges left us. They visited them, but they walked part of the way back with them. Walked with them halfway. On our return, sheltered under the hollies during a hail shower, the withered leaves danced with the hailstones. William wrote a description of the storm. And we actually know what that poem is. It's called A Whirl Blast from Behind the Hill. And then the next entry on the 19th, William and I walked to the hilltops. A very cold, bleak day. William wrote some lines describing a stunted thorn. And then we looked at the poetry. See, the thorn. So it's lovely to be able to trace that direct connection. Wordsworth himself relates in his commentary to Lyrical Ballads how it was in the course of a long walk taken by himself, his sister, and Coleridge along the coast in Somerset that the Lyrical Ballads and The Ancient Mariner was planned. Well, no, you know that's by Coleridge, but on that walk, Wordsworth claimed to have invented at least 2 of the lines, he said. But it was obviously an inspiration to Coleridge and to Wordsworth himself. It's a recurring metaphor throughout the prelude, which is that of a journey whose end, as T.S. Eliot put it in the 4 quartets, and those of you who came to my Eliot lecture will, of course, remember this, with its musical title, The Prelude, The 4 Quartets. His end of the journey is in its beginning, and Eliot puts it, to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Lovely words, aren't they? I wish I were lecturing on Eliot. I'm always warned strictly off poetry, but I always try and sneak it in. The prelude opens with a literal journey, yes, a walk to Grasmere. And I'm coming to an end now with Wordsworth, described in a blank verse which suits its subject perfectly. And I think this is also interesting, that walking in some cases gives the rhythm and the form to the work which it produces. And Simon Armitage says, it operates walking both as an indulgence and a restraint, as does the blank verse, encouraging a flowing lyrical style suited to the intoxication of travel, but always at a measured and regular pace. And of course, that takes us back to walking. I'll just read you this extract, and then I promise we'll go on to the main subject of the lecture. But I felt you needed sort of getting into it. There, and you'll know this passage too, I'm sure, and you see here his slight guilt at his bird nesting, but his intoxication as a young boy among those mountains. Have you been to the Lake District? Has anybody been to the Lake District? Yes. Amazing. Quite stunning scenery. Fair seed time had my soul, and I grew up fostered alike by beauty and by fear, much favoured in my birthplace, and no less in that beloved vale to which ere long we were transplanted. There we were let loose for sports of wider range. Ere I had told 10 birthdays, when among the mountain slopes, frost and the breath of frosty wind had snapped the last autumnal crocus, 'twas my joy with stores of springes, that's traps for the birds, o'er my shoulder hung, to range the open heights where woodcock ran along the smooth green turf. Through half the night, scudding away from snare to snare, I plied that anxious visitation. Moon and stars were shining o'er my head. I was alone and seemed to be a trouble to the peace that dwelt among them. Sometimes it befell in these night wanderings that a strong desire o'erpowered my better reason, and the bird, which was the captive of another's toil, became my prey, and when the deed was done, I heard among the solitary hills low breathings coming after me, and sounds of undistinguishable motion, steps almost as silent as the turf they trod. Lovely stuff. Mind you, good to have stamina to finish 12 books of it. It's a crucial metaphor, walking, travelling, going in his poetry. Now, finally, dear Jane. There's no doubt that Jane Austen, who was 5 years younger than Wordsworth, I always think of her as being older, born before him, I mean, not older because she died quite young, didn't she? But she was definitely familiar with Wordsworth, because in an unfinished novel, Sanditon, started but never finished in 1817, the year she died, by which time a lot of Wordsworth's poetry had been published, Sir Edward Denham, one of the characters, attempts to enthuse the heroine, unsuccessfully, Charlotte Heywood, about Wordsworth and Sir Walter Scott. Whether this is Jane Austen's sly way of saying I'm not very keen on Wordsworth, I don't know, but she definitely knew his work. And also, those of you who know Pride and Prejudice, and I can't assume all of you have read it, but I'm sure most of you have, will remember that Elizabeth is terribly disappointed when her uncle and aunt have to curtail the visit she makes with them and can't visit the Lake District. She had set her heart on seeing the lakes. So that shows you there is this sort of connection, I think, with the Wordsworthian ethos. Whether she admired his work or not, however, is impossible to judge. What we can say with certainty, however, as Anne Wallis puts it, now this is a fascinating book, but hard going, I warn you. Maybe that's a challenge to some of you. It's called Walking Literature and English Culture. And it very carefully and cleverly, I think that's part of the problem, of course, cleverly defines the role of walking in the 19th and early 20th century. She says that Jane Austen's novels frame the window of attitudinal and practical change in respect to walking. In Austen's work, she argues, as we'll see ourselves in Pride and Prejudice, a taste for walking and respect for other pedestrians becomes signs of the virtue Austen ascribes to the best of the English landed gentry. In other words, those who like to walk are goodies. Those who don't like walking are baddies. I'll try to demonstrate this. I think she's probably right. I think it's rather heavy language in which to describe it. Gentlemen and gentlewomen in Jane Austen are distinguished as readily by their willingness, even their desire to walk, as by their common sense, independence of opinion, think Mr. Knightley, unostentatious economy, country living, and what Mr. Knightley calls in Emma, English delicacy towards the feelings of others. He's impossibly virtuous, Mr. Knightley, isn't he? I love him, especially paid by Jeremy Northam. But it would take longer for women to enjoy pedestrian pleasures, faced as they were with tremendous barrier of prejudice and opposition, not encountered by men. Though certain types of women had been walking the roads of England for centuries, tinkers, peddlers, other working class women couldn't afford the fare, as well as a few strong-minded women of the educated classes who dared to travel alone, tradition was completely against respectable women walking. Females taking even short walks in the country alone were rather frowned upon. And no, well, you remember Pride and Prejudice, we'll come to that. And no lady, of that time would have dared to indulge in a walking tour. Just wouldn't have been accepted. Dorothy Wordsworth put herself right outside the pale by walking with her brother all over the place, tramping rather inelegantly. For as Maurice Marples observes, You can see why I like him, because he's got a lot more wit and he's a lot more light-hearted than our friend Anne Wallace. This was the time, he says, when ladies were supposed to be delicate creatures, who did not eat much, who fainted easily, well, of course, I blame the corsets, but never mind, who were more properly occupied in the pursuit of accomplishments such as music, painting, dancing, and the superficial acquisition of foreign languages than in physical exercise. The female form, it was thought, was incapable of vigour or of sustained movement. A lady who wanted to visit scenes of picturesque beauty must travel by post chaise. Even fresh air in any but the smallest quantities was considered rather risky for these frail plants, who were so apt to sink into a decline. The open air itself, the wind and the rain, would surely have been fatal. He's so lovely, Maurice Marples. I think I ought just to read from his book, actually. Yet gradually, women, too, were beginning to be affected by the changed attitude to walking, heralded by Wordsworth. And Jane Austen is a prime example of this. I mean, I think her attitude in her books, and I don't want to labour it, but I think her attitude in her books is very positive about walking. Those who walk, walking itself, the opportunities that it offers to those who do so. Of course, in Jane Austen's case, it may have been the influence of having so many brothers. She had one sister, Cassandra, and she had six brothers, which encouraged this more robust attitude. Any of you who have brothers will know that they do tend to be more robust about physical activity. Well, perhaps not so much nowadays. By comparison with Wordsworth and his friends, Jane Austen did not walk far, however. And the gentle Hampshire scenery in which her house, and I was very proud of myself, I'm sorry it's not clearer, that's her first house, Steventon Rectory, because her father was a rector, a vicar, and that's where she grew up. But after her father's death, she was, and her family, her mother and her sister, were given another house, which they describe as a cottage. If you've seen the film Sense and Sensibility, you'll have had the same reaction. They're talking about going to, you know, to this cottage, and you look up at it and you think, splendid Georgian house, can I live there? You know. But she, of course, gentle Hampshire scenery cannot hold a candle to dramatic, wild, rugged Lake District. But Austen walked regularly, and by making her characters in her novels enjoy the activity, she manages to convey the genuine pleasure in walking. None of her books is without reference to it. I mean, for example, in Northanger Abbey, Catherine Morland goes walking and finally decides between which man she's going to marry by realising that the superficial thoughts don't like walking and want to go by carriage. Now, you may think I'm exaggerating, but actually, if you look very carefully, you'll see. Those who like walking are good. Those who don't like walking are decadent. And in Sense and Sensibility, of course, they walk, particularly, not always sensibly. The Dashwood girl's younger, the younger Dashwood girl, Marianne, Sensibility. Do you remember those long, wild rambles across the moor or across the fields? And, of course, caught in a storm and rescued by the dashing Mr. Willoughby. No, is it? Willoughby, yes. It is Willoughby, isn't it?
Yes,
thank you. I've got a checker here. Willoughby, who turns out to be no good at all. He's on his horse, of course. So. In Pride and Prejudice, started in 1896, there are so many walks that you'll have to stop me. And each of them fulfills a different kind of a different purpose. I mean, sometimes it's to show you character, sometimes it's to forward the plot, often to forward the plot. I called this walking into plot. Sometimes for privacy, sometimes to show, just to show you what good eggs they are. So too does Emma in the novel of that name. Do you remember the walk down the lane so that they'd accidentally bump into the clergyman, that horrid clergyman? They're always horrid clergymen. I think because her father was a vicar, they had so many awful curates that she had a kind of thing about them. But they're walking down the lane, and she pretends her shoe has come undone. But there was so little that they could do as women in that world. But they could at least go for a gentle walk. Even that walk turns out to be rather dangerous when the gypsies attack. And in her last novel, Persuasion, Anne Elliot shows an even greater and almost Wordsworthian sensitivity to what Austen calls the peculiar and inexhaustible influence of nature on a mind of taste and tenderness. All this against a background of social disapproval. Like her heroine Lizzie, Elizabeth Bennet, she has a great deal of independence. And that's, you know, that is really proof enough, if proof were needed, of how important it seemed to Jane Austen. Even in these novels, ostensibly about, of course, love and marriage and money and mistakes and foolishness and education and all sorts of things. One of the great advantages of using walking to advance the plot, which is, for Jane Austen, one of the first things that she realises, that you can use it. I mean, you've got these people stuck in a drawing room. How do you progress the plot? You take them out for a walk. Then they meet somebody else. Then that person introduces another element into the plot. Now, if you read it in that way, you will see how very important walking is. It appears, I mean, she wants to make, she's a brilliant plotter. And what I think is very important in a brilliant plot is that it should seem inevitable. That it should seem, of course, that is the thing that would happen next, because that's just happened. And of course he's charming, and of course she'll believe Wickham. And then, you know, of course, because she believes Wickham, she won't see what a rogue he is. And when he runs away with her little sister and won't marry her, she'll have been totally unprepared. But we, of course, have been alerted, and there have been lots of walks and talks on the way. So she does use it, and she does want to make that plot seem natural. When they go into Meryton to shop, for example, well, they're not really shopping. They're shopping for men, aren't they? Don't you think? I mean, they're going in because Longbourn is now full of the regiment that has come, and you notice how very cleverly she sneaks in the Napoleonic Wars. She doesn't tell you that the war's going on, but the men are being posted away from Meryton towards the end of the novel, and we realise that things are hotting up. So there's very little mention, but a background which is realistic. And I think walking for her enables her to introduce a perfectly realistic plot, but a plot which is full of excitement and drama. As you know, it revolves around the marriage, or the marrying off, I should say, of Mr. and Mrs. Bennet's 5 daughters in difficult circumstances. His estate is entailed, that is to say, and this will be one of the main themes of the book, that if he doesn't have a son, he doesn't get the money. He doesn't get the estate. It passes to his cousin, the odious Mr. Collins, which, of course, nicely comes in into the plot. Everything flows with a pleasing sense of inevitability from that premise, because everybody is looking for a husband. Not because they particularly want a husband, but because if they don't have a husband, they don't have independence. And even then they don't have independence, but it's a kind of, you know, they probably have a bit more money anyway. They certainly wouldn't have to stay at home to look after mummy and daddy. The eldest daughter Jane's relationship with Mr. Bingley is the first strand of that plot. And, you know, it wouldn't do to have her marry him immediately, would it? There has to be drama, there has to be tension, there has to be a crisis for a good plot. And so Mr. Bingley and Jane have a long and difficult relationship, which ends happily, of course, after all, because this is the 19th century. The second daughter, Elizabeth, our favourite, are they? Is she? Well, she's certainly mine. Is Jane's confidant and her father's favourite, and her equally, if not more tortured, relationship with Mr. Darcy, which we'll come to in a minute, interrupted comically by that proposal of marriage from Mr. Collins. I love it. I think it's one of the best scenes in the book. And the third daughter, Lydia's elopement, with Mr. Wickham, who has initially paid attention to Elizabeth. Wickham, who is without money through his own fault, we gradually realise, but who needs to marry money and who has no intention of marrying the daughter of a man whose estate is entailed on a male descendant. So that is how the plot works. And it's very simple, isn't it? I mean, it's very typical of the times that you should have daughters that you need to marry off. Mind you, I wouldn't mind marrying two of mine off. Perhaps I'd have fewer daily calls. What shall I do, mother? Totally irrelevant. These three main strands are woven seamlessly together, mainly, I think, through a series of crucial walks. When Mrs. Bennet makes Jane go by horse, this is the first of the very important examples. Do you remember she makes her go by horse? Why? So that she will get wet, possibly, hopefully, on the way and have to stay. Of course, Jane becomes ill. And in those days, a cold was not, I was going to say, not to be sniffed at. Why do I keep saying that? A cold was not to be taken lightly in those days. And Jane is uncomplaining, but Elizabeth, her favourite sister, her great confidant, feels very, very strongly that she must go to visit her sister. And Mr. Bennet says, but the horse for their one carriage is working in the fields. And Elizabeth says, I'll walk. And they say, you walk? You can't walk. And she says, I like walking. It's a pleasant activity. I enjoy it. And of course walks the 3 miles and arrives looking very healthy with mud on her skirt. And Mr. Bingley and Darcy think, what a good colour. How animated she looks. How attractive. And the sisters think, how disgraceful. It's a very nice scene, isn't it? And of course it's part of the plot, because Mr. Darcy then thinks for the first time, what an attractive woman. There are all sorts of walks in that little scene. There's the walk around the drawing room with one of the Miss Bingleys, which is really I love the film actually, Pride and Prejudice, where they walk around the drawing room and she's looking terribly superior and much taller than Elizabeth, and I identify totally with that. This elegant lady walking around, and he says, you're only doing it so that I will admire what fine figures you are. And it's true. When they walk in the garden, they do it really more so that they can talk to Mr. Darcy and flirt with him, because Miss Bingley has got her eye on him. And there's no room for Elizabeth. That's a very important point. Elizabeth has to walk alone. And she prefers it. She prefers to be just behind. There aren't, of course, some of the things can't be dealt with by walks. The walk, the ball. Would you count dancing as walking? No, I can't. But there are several balls in the thing. But the next important walking is after Mr. Collins's proposal and Lizzie's refusal. We'll read her father's response later on when I talk about the humour of Pride and Prejudice. Mr. Collins' proposal and Lizzie's refusal follow, then his swift change of direction. Never did a man decide so quickly to propose to another woman. And Charlotte sees her chance and nips in. I like to think that they went back by carriage. They're neither of them worthy. And then this is the next bit of walking, when she visits Charlotte at the rectory in the grounds of Rosings, where, of course, fortuitously, she's going to meet Darcy, but she doesn't know it. And she prefers not to walk in the garden. She doesn't want to walk in that tame, civilised little bit. But along, and this I'm quoting, but along the open grove which edged that side of the park, where there was a nice sheltered path which no one seemed to value but herself, and where she felt beyond the reach of Lady Catherine's de Bourgh, curiosity. And I think we could take this as a very clear sign, again, of her individuality, the fact that she's not going to walk where she's supposed to walk, safely in the garden. Very, of course, very allegorical. Both Darcy, who turns out to be the nephew of Lady Catherine, and his friend Colonel Fitzwilliam also walk. They walk daily to the parsonage to see Elizabeth, of course, although she didn't realise this. And she keeps meeting Darcy in her rambles in the park. That's another quote. And Colonel Fitzwilliam. And on these walks, everything unfolds. After he's proposed to her, and she's absolutely shocked, and he wants to explain himself, he meets her by chance, which of course it isn't, in the park, and gives her the letter of explanation. It's only when they get out of the drawing room, out of the garden, that the independent spirits are allowed to operate. And of course, you know the most famous example of all, when she goes on that coach trip to the lake, it was going to be to the Lake District, but it turns out to be to Derbyshire. Oh, it's all right, they say, Mr. Darcy is away. And it's while they're walking in his grounds that he comes hot foot after them, having arrived mercifully one day early. And then, of course, you can't have too much of a resolution, or else where would the rest of the book go? And so she has to wait while her sister disgraces her. Darcy rushes off to the rescue, though she doesn't know it, and her sister is finally made a respectable woman. An honourable man has married her, bribed by Darcy, of course. All these walks, but we must have an example of this. And my favourite example is your extract, mine. It's becoming quite clear that Mr. Darcy still wants to marry Lizzie. It's becoming clear to poor Lizzie that her sister's disgraced her, and that he will have no intention of doing so now. But of course, we know better as the audience. And when Lady Catherine, Darcy's aunt, arrives to tell her off and to warn her off and to warn her not to marry her nephew, she says, in order to have, you know, some kind of privacy, "Oh, that's a nice little piece of rough ground over there. Let's go for a walk." In other words, "Let's get away from your family. I want to talk to you." As soon as they entered the copse, Lady Catherine began in the following manner. "You can be at no loss, Miss Bennet, to understand the reason of my journey hither. Your own heart, your own conscience, must tell you why I came." Elizabeth looked with unaffected astonishment. "Indeed, you are mistaken, madam. I have not been at all able to account for the honour of seeing you here." "Miss Bennet," replied her ladyship in an angry tone, "you ought to know that I am not to be trifled with. But however insincere you may choose to be, you shall not find me so. My character has never been celebrated, has ever been celebrated for its sincerity and frankness, and in a cause of such moment as this, I shall certainly not depart from it. A report of a most alarming nature reached me 2 days ago. I was told that not only your sister was on the point of being advantageously married, but that Miss Elizabeth Bennet would in all likelihood be soon afterwards united to my nephew, my own nephew, Darcy." Of course, it's the first Elizabeth has heard of it. "Though I know it may be a scandalous falsehood, though I would not injure him so much as to suppose the truth of it possible, I instantly resolved on setting off for this place that I might make my sentiments known to you." "If you believed it impossible to be true," said Elizabeth, colouring with astonishment and disdain, "I wonder you took the trouble of coming so far. What could your ladyship propose by it?" "At once to insist upon having such a report universally contradicted." "Your coming to Longbourn to see me and my family," said Elizabeth coolly, "will be rather a confirmation of it, if indeed such a report is in existence." "If? Do you then pretend to be ignorant of it? Has it not been industriously circulated by yourselves? Do you not know that such a report is spread abroad?" "I never heard that it was." "And can you likewise declare that there is no foundation in it?" "I do not pretend to possess equal frankness with your ladyship. You may ask questions which I shall not choose to answer. And of course, during all of this, they're strolling about, and Elizabeth is showing her true mettle. She's not going to be pushed around by Lady Catherine. This is not to be borne, Miss Bennet. I insist on being satisfied. Has he, my nephew, made you an offer of marriage? Your ladyship has declared it to be impossible. It ought to be so. It must be so while he retains the use of his reason, but your arts and allurements may, in a moment of infatuation, have made him forget what he owes to himself and to all his family. You may have drawn him in. If I have, I shall be the last person to confess it. Miss Beck, this is my favourite line, do you know who I am? I give a lecture at a place where they don't really know me. They say, oh, Dr. Wilson's up there. And I say, do you know who I am? I don't really. Do you know who I am? I have not been accustomed to such language as this. I am almost the nearest relation he has in the world and am entitled to know all his dearest concerns. But you are not entitled to know mine, nor will such behaviour as this ever induce me to be explicit. Let me be rightly understood. This match to which you have the presumption to aspire can never take place. No, never. Mr. Darcy is engaged to my daughter. Now, what have you to say? Only this, that if it is so, he is so, you can have no reason to suppose he will make an offer to me. It's so witty, isn't it? I mean, you can imagine what a delightful conversation she was. And, of course, the last walk of the book, that wonderful walk, where the walk gives them the opportunity to lag behind and be on their own, be away from that ever-inquisitive family of Mrs. Bennet and the younger sisters, and to finally realise that Darcy loves her still and has proposed again. It's a lovely last passage, and it is, I insist, concluded with a walk. All's well that ends well. Such a plot, told with such apparent simplicity, is ideal for Austen's purpose, which is to convey a moral without appearing to do so. In the course of it, she satirises the vanities, sillinesses, even wickedness of mankind, Lydia, Mrs. Bennet, and Wickham, sort of some of the sort of minor villains, and praises the morally sound and good, Elizabeth, Jane, and when they have suffered sufficiently, Darcy and Bingley. On the surface, one of Austen's most light-hearted novels, she herself commented on the playfulness and epigrammatism of the general style. When one looks below the surface, and that wit and brilliance, of course, is very distracting, but when you look below, it contains highly serious themes. The title alone, Pride and Prejudice, which started out as First Impressions, highlights two themes which will be addressed throughout the book. The first of these, of course, is pride, and it's generally attributed only to Darcy, but of course Elizabeth has her own pride, which will not be attacked, she thinks, or will not be overcome. And there's a lovely passage there, extract 4, which I can't read. Wickham's comments on Darcy's pride are equally interesting because, of course, he can give a lovely distorted picture of what Wickham was like as a young man. But when it comes to prejudice, Elizabeth, however much we love her, is not blameless. She's decided right from the start when he says, I wouldn't want to dance with that woman, or words to that effect, that he's horrible. And her prejudice continues for a very long time into the novel. The theme of parental guidance comes in, doesn't it? Or lack of it. It runs throughout the book as the incredibly silly Mrs. Bennet fails to control her youngest daughter, one of whom runs off at 15 with the man who has no intention of marrying her. Elizabeth's father, Mr. Bennet, who is an intelligent, cultured man, but one suspects a little lazy, fails to put his foot down, a mistake he finally acknowledges ruefully. And when Elizabeth says to him, "You must not be too severe upon yourself," he says, "You may well warn me against such an evil, Lizzie. Human nature is so prone to fall into it. No, Lizzie, let me once in my life feel how much I have been to blame. I am not afraid of being overpowered by the impression. It will pass away soon enough." So he knows what he's like. He knows that this is not an impression which will continue as long as it ought. A lot of insight into character. Sentimentality is personified in the vapid Mrs. Bennet, and here the opening page of the novel. If I hadn't indulged myself with Lady Catherine de Bourgh and her walk, would be the one I would read when Mr. Bennet comes in and says there's a new neighbour. And she says, "Oh, we must go and visit. Oh, he's going to marry one of my daughters." And it's a wonderful scene and shows the superficiality and stupidity of the woman, that she thinks that she can just set this out and set it going. Hypocrisy do is dealt with in a deceptively light manner in the comic figure of Mr. Collins. Mr. Bennet, who clearly shares Elizabeth's dislike of the odious little man, makes his feelings quite plain when he speaks to her. His wife is beside herself. She was about to marry one of her daughters, and the daughters refused the offer. And the offer included getting the whole house and grounds back. I mean, it's quite an offer to refuse, really, in the circumstances. And she says, "You must talk to her, Mr. Bennet. You must talk to her. You must tell her." And he says, extract 8, "Come here, child." This is halfway down the extract. "Come here, child," cried her father as she appeared. "I have sent for you on an affair of importance. I understand that Mr. Collins has made you an offer of marriage. Is it true?" Elizabeth replied that it was. "Very well. And this offer you have refused?" "I have, sir." "Very well. We now come to the point. Your mother insists upon your accepting it. Is it not so, Mrs. Bennet?" "Yes, or I will never see her again." "An unhappy alternative is before you, Elizabeth. From this day, you must be a stranger to one of your parents. Your mother will never see you again if you do not marry Mr. Collins, and I will never see you again if you do." And of course, Lady Catherine de Bourgh gives Jane Austen the chance to deal with that question of class and rank, because she's not saying in Lady Catherine all people of the upper classes of the aristocracy are awful, but she is indicating that just because you're upper class, you don't have very good manners automatically. You can be rude and aggressive, as we've seen, and I think she deals with that very well. And of course, the other very important theme, perhaps one of the two most important themes at the very centre, a universal theme, is love. Love of child and parent, Lizzie and her father. The love between sisters, Lizzie and Jane. The love between men and women. And the love between friends, to some extent, when Charlotte marries. Very, very extensively dealt with. I knew this should be two lectures. I'm going to have to stop very shortly. And she really does deal with that very thoroughly. But I think the most important theme of all for me, and this is a kind of pre-feminist novel. Everything in this book indicates the helpless position of women and how unfair she regards that as being. It is definitely one of the first of the novels that really deals with this question of the position of women, which Jane Austen herself, of course, experienced, isn't it? And when she questions Charlotte about marrying Mr. Collins, Charlotte says, "I see what you are feeling," replied Charlotte. "You must be surprised, very much surprised, so lately as Mr. Collins was wishing to marry you. But when you've had time to think it over, I hope you will be satisfied with what I have done. I am not romantic, you know." It's the romantic idea of love being connected to marriage is something that Jane believes in, Elizabeth believes in, but Charlotte, who is a spinster of 27, doesn't have much choice. "I am not a romantic, you know. I never was. I ask only a comfortable home. And considering Mr. Collins' character, connections, and situation in life, I am convinced that my chance of happiness with him is as fair as most people can boast on entering the marriage state. So, I mean, it really is, I think, a nail in the coffin. There are so many lovely things to talk about. But what I think is the most extraordinary compliment to Jane Austen is the way in which this plot has been copied over and over again. I've just been re-watching. My husband, to my surprise, said, I'd like Bridget Jones. Mr. Darcy, it's a plot based entirely on Jane Austen's formula, isn't it? The independence and then the dependency on marriage, the desire to be married, the need to be married, and Clueless. Have you ever seen that film, that American film, high school film, Clueless, based entirely on Jane Austen? It's a marvellous compliment, I think, to a early 19th century writer, and how sad that she died as she did, so young in her 40s, with possibly other wonderful... Don't you feel sad when you... I regularly reread. When I come to Persuasion, a great depression descends on me. Thank you.